Every movement has its book. Gritty, raw, and spiritual. Ghetto Plainsman chronicles one man's triumph over humiliation, self-defeat, anger, and violence by taking us on a chaotic journey between urban survival and the life or death struggles of the ravaged American Great Plains. As a modern-day parable for our crashing earth, this gripping story reveals how someone on the cut, hustling, drug dealing, and trying to beat back despair, transforms himself into someone working to save great stretches of the American West that proved to be even more violent and devastated than the inner city. Jared Manos finds comfort on a curb or in the shadows of a deserted street. He sees the world as a constant war zone filled with hatred and ugliness. He burns with backlash resentment. To complicate matters, he is tormented by a self-loathing denial of his sexuality and wants to kill it out of him. From coastal Texas to an 80s, early 90s New York City, under siege by drugs and AIDS, to a xenophobic L.A. wasteland divided by race and class, all the way out into the stricken Great Plains, Manos can barely see the door that Earth has always held open for us. Ghetto Plainsman is the searing journey of one of the Green Movement's most original voices at a time when the world is in crisis and heading into ecological collapse.
Timber House Press's Book Wrap series proudly offers its literary appetizer. Author Jared Manos reading excerpts from his highly acclaimed automythography, Ghetto Plainsman.
Hey, what's up, everybody? This is Jared, founder and CEO of Great Plains Restoration Council and author of this book, Ghetto Plainsman. This book took me more than 8 years to write. And, you know, I was on my way out even by the time I was seven, and now I'm a author, green leader, youth activist, vegan athlete, and I'm a father, too. And I believe you can have the most exhilarating life by getting healthy and giving back. Even if your life is filled with pain, suffering, and struggle, you can find refuge in reaching higher and deeper, and that brings a higher evolving of the human race for all of us. Chapter 1, If You Had No History. Chapter 2, Who Would You Be Then? Chapter 3, Passage in Flight. Chapter 4, Cuerpo y Mar. Chapter 5, I Would Probably Be Cold, Freezing. Chapter 6, Shadow World. Chapter 7, Los Angeles. Chapter 8, Game Crossing. Chapter 9, Mutate and Survive. Chapter 10, Love Dancing. Chapter 11, Dead Man. Chapter 12, Miraflores. Chapter 13, Invasion. Chapter 14, Prairie Earth. Chapter 15, Sun Dogs. Chapter 16, Dive by the Wreck. Chapter 17, Kingpin. Chapter 18, On This Side. Chapter 19, Jihad. Chapter 20, Crack Between Both Worlds. Chapter 21, Sand Creek Still. Chapter 22, On the Other Side. Chapter 23, Red Mist. Chapter 24, Political Prisoner. Chapter 25, Everything Will Now Come Your Way. Chapter 26, Scarred Face. Chapter 27, Refuge. Chapter 28, Things Surely Turn to Autumn. Chapter 29, Unconditional Love Straight Up. And the epilogue, Buffalo Commons, the American West as Afghanistan. This is an excerpt from Chapter 4, Cuerpo de Mar. 1983. Where the hell are you right now? "I am sorry for you," the East Indian woman said, looking at me through the bulletproof glass. She had a small dark red stone glued to her forehead. "There's only the night rates available after 2 a.m. Right now you must pay by the hour." I smelled incense and beans. It wasn't even dark out yet. I just stared at her, my teenaged head hanging, not comprehending. Hot, dirty, and exhausted, I was somewhere in Memphis, Tennessee, having finally escaped Ohio well before dawn, finally heading to my fabled Texas after waiting and planning for so many years. A young, clueless dude on the road starting life over. Somewhere in the darkness before this first dawn, it had occurred to me that I was dead, had died years ago. Too much pressure until I'd burst, died, withered on my vine. But as I would keep finding out, there was always something that dragged me back to my feet, driving me crazy when all I wanted to do was check out and rest forever. Everything now would be a new life, I told myself in Memphis. I tried to focus on that thought, but it fell away beneath the fragments of too many things, and I went blank. Having driven through the night, the morning, and the afternoon, I just wanted to rent a room and sleep. I pulled off the interstate in an industrial warehouse district after seeing the motel sign advertising free movies. My head was so tired, shutting down, didn't trust it to drive even a few more miles. "Well," the woman asked, "you take the room or no?" Behind bulletproof glass, her face was round, slightly oily, but with no expression of any kind, not even impatience, which I'm sure I heard. The ruby-like stone glinted. I checked the sky. Still a few hours before dark. I walked out, finally guessing that the hourly rates meant this was some kind of prostitution place. I was in the middle of some chain-link, crack-pavement wasteland with the interstate elevated and its traffic roaring overhead. I drove around a few blocks, legs cramped from the trip. I saw more factories and warehouses all closed for the weekend. The sky was overcast and the air southern grimy with vehicle soot and humidity. Parking next to an abandoned lot, its chain-link fence sagging and torn, I got out, grabbed my bottle of warm 7-Up, and sank down onto a concrete parking bump. I folded my arms over my knees and dropped my head. Dimly, I heard the repeated slap of a basketball on the pavement and the boom of rap music. I looked up and watched three black dudes playing ball, their shirts off, shiny with sweat. One was very big, tall, and dark-skinned. Mindlessly, I stared at his feet, running and jumping in bright white Run-DMC-style high-top sneakers. I was so tired, my mind drifted. I glanced up at the interstate that I just exited, looking at the rusted fence strung alongside it, tops of speeding vehicles visible behind. I had a sudden image of me being a little kid standing on the overpass above the new interstate in Ohio, my fingers twisting into the links of the already rusting fence that separated me from that freeway and its weed-overgrown, trash-littered slopes, and all the traffic passing beneath me going someplace, somewhere else. I closed my eyes, remembering the dirty, warm, humid air and how the gasoline-scented highway ruffled my wiry black hair. Sometimes I thought my head was like one of them blackbirds just wanting to lift off and fly away, my whole head flying away, clutched beneath wiry black wings. When they'd been building that interstate, they'd had dynamite days. They'd used bombs to open up the earth for the freeway's passage, and the whole kindergarten class had to gather in those safe areas of the school just in case anything shook loose on our heads. Winter caught up with the construction crews before they could finish, and every day after school I rough-sledded down into that giant, unfinished roadbed, bulldozed out of woods and old fields, the taste of snow in my nose. The basketball players decided to take a water break. After drinking from a gallon jug, the big dark dude came jogging over to where I was. I stood and leaned against the front of my car. Still a teen, hadn't reached my full height yet. He ran up. He was maybe in his mid-20s. He glanced at the old maroon-colored Ford and its license plates. "What's up, cuz? Haven't seen you around here before. You lost?" He was breathing through his nostrils, eyes flashing. I wanted to check in the motel, but they say no overnight rates. Not till 2 in the morning, anyway. He bounced the basketball. His bright blue gym shorts shined. So did his white sneakers, white teeth, and whites of his eyes. He was standing close to me. He bounced the ball again. "Nothing around here," he said, glancing back at his friends. "This it." He looked at me for a second longer. I shrugged. He made a motion like he was going to put his right hand out as if to shake, then did it in turn and jogged back to his friends bouncing the ball. I decided to drive some more but was so tired only made it to the next exit. I pulled into a parking lot where a few cars were stored so mine wouldn't look so out of place. I locked the doors, rolled the windows up to about half an inch from the top, and lay down across the old bench-style front seat, stretching my legs the best I could. My feet were swelling inside my shoes, but I was too tired to reach down and take them off. I threw a jacket over my face. Sweaty, sticky, and needing a shower, I passed out thinking about bright white teeth, bright whites of eyes. I settled in Corpus Christi, Texas, which they say is the real windiest city in America. North Beach was a seedy isthmus of dirt and sand, existing in the shadow of the arching harbor bridge just past the oil refineries that lined the shipping channel mouth of the Nueces River flowing into Corpus Christi Bay. I guess it's been redeveloped since, but back then North Beach was its own forgotten, sand and grit-blown beach barrio. The winds would start blowing off the gulf, and as I walked down through the dirt alleys in between flapping clotheslines, yowling cats, and shawled Mexican grandmothers ducking like Arab women, I would begin to feel that the winds and sand were all there was in the world. Or were the world itself one long, sandblasted wind tunnel between shabby, single-room hood houses and stick-stilted apartments that, no matter how many twists and turns, always led back out into the mouth of the giant, growling gulf? Warm weather and the chance to live where the open ocean met the open west. My place was part of a small prefab studio apartment complex up on stilts with only a weedy vacant lot between it and the bay. I was trying to take some community college classes but already was barely showing up anymore. The window faced a cluster of old one-room cottages that served as the eroding edges of the wind-tunneled alleys. The abuelas hung their ropas out to dry and had to shake off the sand coating from each shirt or skirt or pair of work jeans or cloro-breton sheet, revealing a snapping strength inherent in their small, wiry bodies. They set food out in weighted pie tins for the hundreds of tailless alley cats that stalked and seethed over North Beach. In my little apartment, I killed the cucarachas with liquid Dove dish soap, a trick I learned from the old grandmothers across my alley. A 7-Eleven was within walking distance for my $1.79 six-packs of Schaefer beer and half-gallon jugs of cheap Gallo wine. The wind seemed strongest from late evening through the night. They would blow and creak and whistle and groan through the screens, coating my humid, naked, sleeping body with fine dust and grit. This grit was something you could never fully shake or wash out of your sheets. There was always more, and it rasped against my nerve endings as I ground deeper into sleep. There was something toothy about North Beach, with its coarse broiling sand and murky water, dead jellyfishes and broken glass, stingrays, incoming oil freighters, near constant winds, washed up trash, fluttering clotheslines, tailless cats, and shawled abuelas. Something about the changeable weather, sticky humidity, blazing sun, or damp gray or open and dry coastal prairie blue skies and howling, grit-laden night winds. In fact, most of the South Texas Gulf Coast feels like this, toothy, peeled raw, like sand and salt in a sunburn. Not really a paradise or a vacation, but still always beckoning. And sometimes the winds would suddenly stop, completely pull back out to sea, and Corpus Christi Bay became flat as glass. I would dive into it, swimming far enough out to get naked. The Texas sun heated the top layer of water and made me perspire. Broiled by the sun, sweat piercing my shoulder blades as a cleaved water folded back in and over me like wings, I made sure my broad strokes broke only the slightest disturbance. Far enough out, I switched to breaststroke through the water's underpulse, and I was a sea snake, eyes and mouth barely breaking the surface, sky meeting sea and me at water level, puffy clouds in the hot blue sky above providing oasis pools on the water's surface. As I swam further, the nutrient-rich brown water deepened to blue-black, trailing out my breathing mouth. Down below, I knew there were things, big things, roiling in the cooling layers of water, that underpulse, rolling their eyes up at me as I passed overhead, sometimes bumping into my legs. I could see none of them. I was sure some came right beneath my belly before diving down again, and I might only feel them as a tendril of cooler water brought up with their momentum, or a swirl, or nothing at all. If I thought about it, It would scare me, and I quickly pressed the thought from my mind, let the water pulse everything away but arm strokes and sea and sky. I could see straight out the mouth of the bay, to the gulf all the way to forever. And that great plane of water pulled always. I swam more, floating if I got tired, silent gasp for air, bubbles. I stopped and let my legs fall below me, treaded water. Civilization back there beyond the beach. Should I even go back? This excerpt is from I Would Probably Be Cold, Freezing. That's chapter 5, when it didn't last long and ended up in New York City. Wearing baggy clothes and a baseball cap for anonymity, I stepped off the graffiti-tagged 2 train and hopped up the stairs into the blinking, flashing, false daylight brilliance of Times Square. The deuce was still lively, though quieting down a bit. I checked the Newsday building to see if its circling, neon, screaming headline flasher would tell me what time it was. Had to be after midnight. I stopped in the middle of the sidewalk flow of worn-out hookers, drug dealers, and shifting unknown men and checked my balance, inwardly trying to shake the drink from my head. Taking a deep breath, I began walking down 42nd towards 8th. Abandoned old theaters loomed above on either side. Others promised Super Triple X Porno Kinky Total Sex Double Feature, Serena Sucking Sins, and the Best of Vanessa Del Rio, and more. With my baseball cap pulled far down over my eyes, I tried to imagine a straight line for my drunk ass to follow down the sidewalk so I wouldn't wobble, appear out of control. That would show weakness. Hands in pockets, a little dizzy, I parted through the sea of people. Jangled music and hard rap beats from 100 different radios blasted through the street. Black, brown, Asian, white, expressionless faces with complex intentions shined, reflecting the false daylight and crazy blinking lights. Eyes lowered or head on direct, darting, casing, challenging, looking for openings. In nearly every alley or abandoned doorway, glass pipes flared as somebody fired a rock a crack. Impromptu 3-card Monte games were still springing up on overturned cardboard boxes, $20 a bet. Bits and pieces of the continuously moving throng of people were lost or gained as somebody slipped into a peep show or out of a blazing porn emporium. Hookers still on shift stood their ground on every corner, splitting the crowd. I concentrated hard on my imaginary line. I realized I probably reeked of alcohol. This can't be me, I thought. I quickly stopped thinking about anything. I felt some people looking at me. Head spinning, I rounded the corner onto 8th Ave. I leaned up against the wall and tried to act casual, eyeing men for a split second from beneath the ball cap as they walked down the sidewalk between 42nd and 43rd, waiting for something. From across the street, this guy was watching me, standing silhouetted in front of the blinking neon lights of Show World, the biggest emporium of them all. Nearly 20 women dressed in short skirts and high-heeled boots milled on the block, hoping to sponge off the place's popularity. As soon as I noticed him, he crossed diagonally and walked right up to me, hands in his jacket pockets. A cigarette was in his mouth. He was unshaven, about 15 years older than me, medium-skinned, mixed with something. "What's up?" he said. "Nothing." I stuck my hands in my pockets. He narrowed his eyes and tilted his head as he checked me out. "What, you want to check my teeth too?" I asked. This is an excerpt from Chapter 9, Mutate and Survive, still in New York, in the deep of it, when I'm having a conversation with one of my best girls, La Humba. "I wonder how a bare light bulb hanging from the ceiling can get so stained," I said into the phone, wondering out loud to La Humba, who was always my girl, lying on my back on the floor, half on and half off my foam mattress. My head was turned sideways, flat on the linoleum and looking into the kitchen. I stared at the bulb's brown blotches. My eyes traveled across the decaying, damp plaster ceiling, hanging in strips and bulges like a cave, though somehow none of those clumps ever fell. I didn't tell her about the ceiling or puke-green walls or any of the rest. "Jihad," she said, "I don't want to imagine what kind of place you got after the one you had here in L.A., You need to do better for yourself. I don't know how you do it. You have to claim it. You know, I always ask God and Goddess every day for my success. I also burn green candles. You know, green candles helps you bring in money." "I just don't think I'm supposed to pray for little things, only really big, basic things like staying alive and able to walk and things like that. I'm afraid if I did, I'd use up what little I might get, period." "That's nonsense. I ask God and Goddess for whatever I need. We have to claim it." I wanted to change the subject. So it's not even been a whole year yet since we met, I said. God, I can't believe how much has happened. But anyways, baby, I miss you. You're one of the few people I can talk to. Is that so? She said in that warm, comforting way of hers, voice soft as fine black silk, laughing. Well, you know that people meet each other for a reason. Lord, I can't figure out why you and I met, she said. It sounded like she was rolling her eyes. Don't roll your eyes at me, I said. She continued laughing. I'm only joking. I know there is some reason, but I'm used to champagne and Jags and movie scripts. You bring me over a big old bottle of old English beer and two plastic cups. Lord! Take it or leave it, I said. Anyway, it's malt liquor, not beer. Quit being so serious. You know me better than that. When Francois had me in his mansion in Haiti, I had everything. My two pet leopards, Jume and Jumana. Luxury cars, chauffeurs, servants. My own private ocean cove and beach. Everything except my freedom. And I will have that level again, but on my own, before I even get my Oscar. I am claiming it. But just because I am accustomed to having things like that doesn't mean I can't audition to play a street person. I like to have all kinds of people in my life. I mean, I'm living on Los Feliz, and I know you, don't I? I can be comfortable wherever. Almost wherever, I said. Remember Hollywood? My place? And yours? That new pink monstrosity you thought you were getting such a good deal at? Ha! Well, we live and we learn, don't we? There was a comfortable silence. Remember, I said, when you came over to my place on Wilcox and we were sitting on my bed and you wanted to ask me something? Yes. I pictured her slowly drawing her fingernails up and down the phone cord. I grimaced, breaking a little sweat. Well, when you... My throat contracted and I swallowed. My scalp began to feel hot. I closed my eyes. I had to do this. I had to. I'm listening, brother man. Hello, anybody home out there in New York City? I swallowed again, gritting my teeth. In a croaky voice, trying hard not to let it sound nervous, I said, well, that thing you wanted to ask me? I knew what it was you're probably going to ask me. I'm listening. Hum-de-dum-de-dum. Listening to myself breathe on the phone line is always fun. Ugh, I said, not meaning to say out loud. I mean, well, yeah, I think I am that. With guys, I mean. I squeezed my eyes shut and thrust the phone away high from my face, cringing. Well, that's a big step for you, she said in the phone receiver, sounding tinny from this distance. I was once in a three-way relationship for about 2 months. I slowly brought the phone back down to my ear. It was such a trip. She was an actress too, Tania, and his name was McMillan. He was head of his own construction company. God, we were like panthers in that bed. The first time she went down on me, I didn't know what was happening. It was that good. It was always in the afternoon too when the three of us would meet, and these big white curtains were blowing all around us. It was like a movie by, what's that director's name? Oh, anyway, but soon she started getting possessive and not wanting McMillan to come around. And I had to move on. It was fun. But I realized I liked to be penetrated. I don't, I thought to myself. Lahumba, I'm being serious. I don't think it's all the way. I mean, it's probably by, maybe. I mean, because at first I thought for sure you and I were going to make love and I wanted to, but she calmed down and gets serious. I'm listening, Jihad. Go on. Her voice was that soft black silk pillow again. All right, this is an excerpt from chapter 20, Crack Between Both Worlds. It's when I'm deep in it, deep up in it. Look, I said, like I said, we go in. We sit down at the table, each count out our shit steady and calm like pros. Then we leave. Are you in a hurry? Steve asked Ralph. Well, sort of. He seemed to be getting redder in the face. Man, come on, Martin said. We don't do this in the hall like this. I'm not coming in, Ralph said. I gritted my teeth and turned to Ralph. Look, you got the money? Ralph nodded. Martin looked at Steve, then at me. We are all sweating in the hot hallway now. Let me see it, I said. Roger, you got the product? Steve's friend held up a brown paper shopping bag with corded handles on it. I think we need to say we tried and just call it a day, Steve said. Ralph pulled out a folded over large white envelope from inside his shirt. The money's in here. He held it back close to his body. All right, Steve said, half turning to take the brown bag from his friend. This is not how we do business. We'll count it right here. Ralph lunged and snatched the bag, tossing the white envelope at him. I whipped around at the motion. He bolted down the hallway, opened the exit door, and disappeared down the stairwell. It's just cut out pieces of paper, Steve said, ripping open the envelope. Hell fucking no, I said, racing after Philly dude. As I hurried down the stairwell, 2, 3, 4 steps at a time, I heard the door above swing open and Martin follow. I bet he's heading downtown, I yelled back, catching a glimpse of a blue flannel shirt out the door. I'm on him. Right behind you, nigga, Martin yelled. I tore out onto the street and ran. Fuck, no fucking way, $10,000 wholesale worth of shit in there. I turned the corner on West Broadway. Man, I fucked up. I saw a glimpse of him rounding another corner. I geared up my pace, knowing I was in better shape. He turned on Spring Street. Behind him by about 30 seconds, I followed, gearing in harder, running down through the warehouses in Soho, the sticky night air streaming around me like a molten fitted mold. He had a good head start, but I was slowly gaining. He was running for his fucking life. Ha! I glanced behind me and saw Martin following far back. The streets were largely empty. A few cars, people, nobody paying any attention. I bolted across Broadway, saw a dude turn right on Lafayette. He ran diagonally across the street. He was in reach now. I bore in some more, pounding down the sprint. He pulled out a knife and held it up as he fled, shiny blade glinting back the streetlights, his arm swinging by his side, the other clutching the bag like a football. I caught up to within 10 paces of him, and he shot his eyes back, looking crazy at me, his eyes wide. He ran harder, brandishing the knife. "Throw the shit down," I yelled between breaths at his back. Without losing pace, I reached into my own bag and pulled out my big stainless steel, black-handled buck knife as he swiveled his eyes back again at me, like a hunted cow. His head jerked with the realization that I also had a blade. I ran even harder, still 10 full strides behind him. I held that distance and pace momentarily, giving him the option of throwing the shit down. "Man, talk about a fucking punk," I yelled to his back, gulping down air. "You a fucking pussy. You gon' get yours, and so your friends. You don't cross me over anything, let alone some fucking services. Just throw the shit down." He jumped into Canal Street between two cabs speeding west. I shot right through behind him. He ran across the eastbound lanes, then back west across Lafayette to the corner. He suddenly slowed and I nearly ran right up on him just as he threw the bag down and swung around at me, slashing the blade. I braked as hard as I could, at the same time trying to throw myself into reverse and jerk backward. I fell off the curb, tripping, my back hitting the oily pavement with a thud, my knife flying out of my hand. He jabbed his knife down toward my stomach and I knew this was it. I saw the blade coming, it was going right into my abdominals, right to my abs, those ones I always had worked at. I scrambled to push back and gain some distance, but knew it was going to be too late. This is an excerpt from chapter 14 called Prairie Earth. It's right after I finally made it out of New York, at least for the first time, and I've ended up broken arm and everything out, way out in the middle of South Dakota, and it's about October. I walked under the low sailing gray skies, letting the winds push me. A few songbirds blew across my path. I thought I might just fall away. At some point, making it no more than half a mile further, I was down. On my back, in the raw, punched, grassy dirt, I stared up at the sky, stem of grass between my teeth. My hurt arm lay in its frozen crook position on top of my belly. Some black clouds were underscoring the gray ones as the winds continued to battle above me, and surely a big storm was about to happen. But it seemed too gentle, too quiet. Weren't plains storms supposed to be giant, crashing, end-of-the-world deluges? I drifted off, opening and closing my eyes. Soon I smelled ozone as the first few drops of rain fell, and I heard them plop into the white dust near my ears. A drop here, a drop there, on my face, on my bare chest through the opening in my shirt. I closed my eyes, ready for it all. Another drop plipped onto my eyelid, and it rolled down my face into my ear canal. Soon, I knew for sure, the giant skies would tear open, deluge me, wind in my ears like an empty bottle. My stomach rose and fell with my breathing, pushing my slung arm up too. I waited, excited. Time passed. Suddenly, like a giant vacuum, the wind stopped. I opened my eyes a slit, questioning. The sky had flattened out to a bare, overcast gray. The drops no longer fell. Everything grew silent, even my breath, which was barely there now. A rooted, spidery hand of warmth reached up into my back from the ground and seemed to pause there, grasping me, pressed by my weight into the grass and dirt. The warmth spread deeper up into me, moving around as if checking things out, then spilled into my right shoulder. I opened my eyes, listening intently. I could hear nothing, but I sensed this red-orange glow filling me up, loosening me up, tuning me, surging into the hurt areas coming from the ground. After about 10 minutes, afraid to move anything but my arms, I carefully lifted my right arm with my left, then found I could hold it up on its own. It was still hurting, but in a duller way, and I could move it. I gingerly pulled off the sling and for the first time extended my elbow, trying not to wince. I laid my bandaged arm down next to my side and shifted over a little to my right to allow my whole arm, elbow, and shoulder full contact with the earth. The warmth from the ground worked into my elbow, then down into my forearm, into my hand and fingertips. My body tingled. I lay there, arm and shoulder surging. I felt wet inside, maybe like a fresh melon. In another 10 minutes, I again tried flexing my arm. I winced when my elbow dug into the dirt, but the arm worked. It still hurt and throbbed, but the pain didn't flare. It was still broken, still sore, but I knew I was on the other side of healing it now. I sat up, breaking the seal with the ground, and looked around. I got to my feet, wondering how long I could carry the earth's warmth inside me. I stuffed the sling into the waistband of my jeans and found I could walk with my arm hanging regularly, if a little crooked. It took some getting used to. I kept trying to retract it to its injured, frozen position. It throbbed, but I was determined not to go back to the sling. The pain eventually came back bad enough, but I was able to get by with just holding it against my stomach. Walking to the car, moving my fingers back and forth to work on them, I slid with little difficulty under the fence, them hated, bristling, rusted wires reaching out to tear all flesh. A gentle rain began to fall, and so did the temperature. Finding Interstate 90 again, the car and I pushed further west. The rain was nothing at all, just a steady sheeting down my windshield. South Dakota seemed to be saying, "There are few people in this world." I drove miles before another car passed, its headlights shining through the gray, pre-dusk highway mist, a trail of tire-flicked spray in its wake. All right, y'all, thanks for hanging out with me today. If you want to find out more or connect with me on the internet, my website is ghettoplainsman.com. I'm also on Facebook, and you can buy the book at Amazon or at other bookstores. And if it's not at your bookstore, please ask for it. Also, this CD, you can share it with your friends or just pass it on through the internet. We're also looking at setting up a book tour, so we'd like to come to your town. And so, just hit it up, your book clubs, neighborhood group, churches, university, mosques, whatever. This is a conversation for all of us, and it's a journey for all of us. So, and if you want to find out more about my organization, which came up out of this journey, that's Great Plains Restoration Council, and you can find out about us at gprc.org. We basically help kids heal themselves or healing our damaged earth. So that's the journey for all of us. We talk about reaching higher and deeper, and through that we can evolve as a human race as well as within our own lives. So that's what a plains man or a plains woman is. Become a seeker. Don't be afraid of your journey. Ghetto plainsman. Appreciate you, and hit me up. And thanks again for coming on the journey. All right.